Hello, everybody, and welcome to Never Handover Podcast. This is Brian.
And I'm Adam.
And Adam, you be Adam West, and I'll be Burt Ward, and we will drive this podcast that is the Batmobile into the ear holes of all of our rabid fans.
I had a Burt Ward autograph one time. I don't know where that came from or how I got it, but yeah, that's...
Well, you know, it's neither here nor there, but he is an activist, I've read,
yes,
and his later in life, so... we tip our hat collectively. But, you know, today, Adam, special episode, we dig into disc two from the three disc set released by the WWE, the Greatest Factions.
That we do. And we have, there's six matches to talk about tonight. And as we were here
now,
in the warm, there's maybe two of them were good.
Maybe. That could be generous. We will see here momentarily. Now, Adam, disc one and disc three have seven matches. This two, which we're talking about tonight in depth, only has six, but they're beefy.
they're quite long, too.
I do want to point out one correction. On the last episode, I said that there were two War Games matches on disc two that we would be discussing. There are two War Games matches yet to come, but only one's on this disc. There's actually another War Games match on disc three. But speaking of War Games, Adam, if you have nothing else to kind of kick us off here, do you want to jump right into the action?
Yeah, we can do that. I really don't have much to say before we jump in, so might as well just go ahead and jump in. Anyway, the first match on this disc is the War Games match from Fall Brawl of 98. So the thing with this match was, it's three teams against each other, and then the entrants come out kind of Royal Rumble style.
Yeah.
So every, what? So you have the periods. And then,
they said it was 5 minutes, but there was no way that was right. No,
the first period was 5 minutes, and then the traditional period was 2 minutes.
But at that sounds closer.
You had a random person coming out from each team.
And they also said, too, not only were the order was random, so you, I guess, conceivably could have gotten two people from this, you know, same team out one after another. I don't know if that happened, but they kind of played to that.
I don't recall if they did or not, but basically the three teams were, you had Team Page, which was DDP, Roddy Piper, and Ultimate Warrior.
Now, I want to step in real quick, Adam. That was Team WCW.
Oh, sorry, Team WCW.
This next team, Adam, I got to do the honors, because I laughed and laughed and laughed. The idea of these three men being joined together, I had no recollection of this. And to me, this is just pure wrestling bliss. It definitely hits me right on my funny bone. Team Hollywood, which is Hollywood Hulk Hogan, of course,
mm-hmm.
Bret Hart, and here's the real kicker, Stevie Ray.
Stevie Ray. I'm still confused as to how he wound up.
Shoulder to shoulder, side by side, fighting alongside Hulk Hogan. And in fact, they kind of run the roost towards the end of the match, just the two of them taking over. Who knew? I did not realize that their careers had kind of aligned in Carolina.
I didn't either. And then, you know, I wonder if Stevie Ray called anybody sad sack ass fruit booty.
Yeah, get those fruit booties, baby.
Or if he has
funny car racing.
Yeah, or if he
all that good stuff. Team Wolfpack rounds us out, and that was Kevin Nash, Sting, and Lex Luger. Are definitely probably the crowd favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Adam, too, this particular faction that was being covered for this segment on the DVD was the NWO, which is kind of an unwieldy, you know, I mean, it's such a big faction. They've had their own DVD in recent years. And so to be included on this almost felt like overkill. And then you get this overstuffed, kind of overbooked match. And before we jump into the action itself, just to kind of further give context. So this was War Games, as you mentioned, 94 Fall Brawl.
98, not 94.
Yes. I'm thinking of, I believe, Survivor Series, which is yet to come.
It's late.
A little spoiler alert. I must have fallen into that hot tub time machine. But Adam, this was at the Lawrence Joel Veterans Memorial Coliseum. Long name, but it's kind of funny because I actually went last year to Winston-Salem for my first time. I have a buddy down there. And little did I know that small town was host to this show. But even more interesting, North Carolina, Adam, I don't know if you knew this, hosted Fall Brawl from 95 through 1999. And 95 was in Raleigh, but at 96 to 99 were all in Winston-Salem.
Yeah.
Then I think Russo and company took it to New York in 2000, but we won't go there.
No, that's another show for another day.
Another statistic I want to toss in here, just to add a little paprika to this chili, to this dish. 11,528 people were there, and the only reason I made a note of that was the year prior, there was about 400 more paid, and that was with Mongo Steve McMichael in the main event. I don't know what that says. I don't know if I want to read too much in between those lines, but let's let that speak for itself.
Yeah, let's do that. And it doesn't looks like these are the Fall Brawl, the Fall Brawl shows. And actually it says here on the generous site, Wikipedia, it says it's from 96 to 99 was Fall Brawl.
Oh, yeah.
The 95 show was somewhere else in the South, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, it was in, if I'm not mistaken, it was in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah, it looks like those Fall Brawl shows were the only shows ever featured at that arena, so.
Yeah.
Wrestling shows.
Bret Hart is coming down to the aisle, Adam, and there's these really, I really noticed this on more on the rewatch, because I watched the set a couple times, and there was some really bad dubbed boos. I don't know if it was, some trying to cover some copyrighted music or what, but there was some really bad fake booing as Brett came down.
And that could have been just WCW piping in fake boos, you know?
I think Tony even acknowledged the boos, so yeah, I was kind of not sure exactly the legitimacy of that. And he starts the match off, the first two entrants is Hart and Diamond Dallas Page. And I gotta say, particularly his hair more wild than ever. DDP kind of looked like my mechanic's junkie stepbrother that sells dime bags to middle schoolers.
Definitely was not on the DDP yoga at that time.
And, Adam, I'm a huge movie buff, which will, that will kind of seep into my commentary, even on this show, here and there. And as such, I want to say they probably should have hired Bret Hart for that new Terminator movie coming out this summer, because he was so mechanical.
Yeah.
Here early.
The whole thing was just coasting.
It's a real mess. We kind of work our way through it, I think that will become evident. And then when we reach our conclusion, we can kind of give our final thoughts on it. But yeah, you're right. This was a mess. So third guy down to the ring was Stevie Ray.
Yep. And I noted here that Stevie Ray, that nobody reacted to anything, and I wouldn't react to Stevie Ray's entrance either.
Yeah, he gets down to the ring, and he's got Slapjack written on his ass. He's got ass text. One of those great wrestling traditions, especially on the independent circuit, ass text. And Ray's ass text was Slapjack. Which, if you wasn't familiar with his foreign object of choice, and you just saw that on the back of his ass, that ass text, you'd probably be like, somebody's uncle got brought down to the show, or something, and had no idea who Stevie Ray was. What's that say on his buttocks? That ass text?
Slapjack, Bobby.
And so he comes out throwing punches. Some of them look like they didn't connect at all. Some were decent. No. DDP hit a double clothesline on Hart and Ray, leading us to our next entrant, Adam. And this was one of the few legitimate pops I detected from this match. It was Sting. Yep. And his red face paint and his giant trench coat right off the set of Matrix Revolutions. And the crowd was hot, man.
Yeah. And Sting looked ridiculous, too.
Yeah. Well, what was the most ridiculous thing about Sting, Adam, and I hope you remember this bump, or this spot, I should say, he tried to leap over, because there's two rings. Yeah. This is traditional war games. He tried to leap from one ring into the other, doing this flying clothesline onto Stevie Ray, and he kind of connected, but he also didn't clear the ropes, the hurdle, and he basically trips up his feet and lands on his head.
I think I remember that now.
First big bump of the night, and he did it to himself.
Yeah, I noted that here. I noted it was a dive by Sting, but I didn't mention the fact that it was he crashed and burned there.
Yes.
He also had red boots, black pants, red face paint, and red and black NWO shirt. That is not a good... It was not a good look at all. It was just awful.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely one of those many incarnations of Sting. And Brett hit a power driver on Paige. Always love seeing that move busted out, especially since we don't get it very often these days. Roddy Piper, one of my old favorites, was next. And so, this introduces a plot thread here, a trope in the match that I did not see coming, and I'm still very confused as to why, and the announcers never really painted the picture for me, so I don't know if you can add to this, but Piper starts hitting his teammate, Paige.
What?
And at this point, Tony Schiavone starts saying, well, it's every man for himself.
Well, I don't think they knew what was going on either, so...
I mean, it's really one of the most confused... Out of context, like, maybe at the time this was covered and the weeks, you know, preceding this on TV, but I had no idea what was happening or why, and it's so unpredictable in that at some points people are fighting amongst, you know, their teammates. At other points, teammates are, you know, working together cohesively, and so very strange...
Well, the thing with this match was that, yes, there were three teams, but it pretty much was every man for himself, because the winner, the guy who got the pinfall at the submission or whatever, he became the number one contender to the world title at Halloween Havoc.
We were all waiting and watching back at home with bated breath for Stevie Ray to get that big title shot. But...
Yeah, Goldberg against Stevie Ray, that'll put some butts in the seats.
Speaking of Stevie, he got the 127 hours treatment, like the Danny Boyle film, where the guy gets stuck in between the two boulders, because he got jammed in between the two rings as Sting was stepping on him.
Did you catch Tony Schiavone's remark on that too?
No.
Stevie Ray got stuck between the ring, and then Tony remarked, "Someone looking like Stevie Ray is getting pummeled."
Oh, well, it could have just been a fan that had a close resemblance, a facsimile of Stevie Ray. Maybe they were
stunt double.
Maybe they were selling Stevie Ray mask at the concession stand there in Winston-Salem. Lex Luger enters next, Adam, looking like the ghost of wrestling past. Kevin Nash comes out next, and to another pretty hot pop. I mean, this was Wolfpack Country, apparently. And as Nash enters into the ring, we get introduced to our next big plot device and kind of the overarching one in this match. Hogan slithers out before his entrance, and it sets up this chain of events, Adam, that really kind of dictates where the match goes.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly. He enters the ring with a foreign object. It's later seen to be Stevie Ray's patent slapjack yet again. As earlier preluded to on his ass text. But
the thing is, when Nash came in, somebody in the match actually gave a shit, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, he came in kind of a house of fire, a little bit more mobile than we remember him.
The thing with Hogan came out and they nailed, you know, he nailed everybody with that slapjack except for Stevie Ray. And then everything just completely stopped.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, too. I can't remember if Hogan had any Aztecs or not. But, yeah, so the slapjack usage, he first whacks Nash and Piper. Then he goes into the second ring and looks at the guys and then pretty much single-handedly wipes them all out. And then, and yet another one of these weird twists, the last three guys standing are all three members of Team Hollywood,
yeah.
Brett, Stevie, and Hogan. And then all of a sudden, Stevie, like, chop blocks Brett, and they take Brett out, and so now you just have standing tall Stevie Ray and Hulk Hogan. It's very odd visual.
Yes, very, and I can't believe Stevie Ray was as big a part of a match as he was.
Oh, he was huge.
I don't know if he was getting a major push at the time or what was going on.
And then Stevie, he stuffs the slapjack back into his sweaty tights.
Oh, no.
And we go back over to the first ring, and Hogan drops not one, but two leg drops onto a prone Kevin Nash.
Yeah.
Who is, you know, sitting there with his eyes closed, playing dead, probably just counting up in his head, you know, how much money he was earning that night or what the bar tab might be when they left North Carolina the next day. But all of a sudden, Adam, smoke fills the ring, and I got to tell you, this looked like RVD and Sabu's rental car. There was so much smoke.
Same thing. I was thinking, I was trying to come up with a good was trying to come up with a good pot joke in my notes, but I couldn't come up with one. I just, what the fuck, smoke starts filling the ring, and a fake warrior appears, Hello Renegade, which Hogan nails, and then real warrior appears, with bullshit ensuing, and Hogan locking warrior inside the cage while everyone else plays dead.
Yeah, there was a fake warrior in a giant warrior white trench coat that gets immediately taken out, which was more smoke.
Yeah.
Yeah, more smoke filtering, and then we got the actual warrior, who I got to say, Adam, he had such a short... That's one of the most fascinating runs, for me personally, that's kind of captured my attention, is Warrior and WCW, because it was so short and so bereft of anything, of substance, that every little morsel I get from it, I try to really study and see if there's anything there. Because he was such an important, at least, character. I'm not talking to his ability... or his credit as a performer, but he was such an integral part to that kind of, 90s WWF scene.
Mm-hmm.
That I always, there should have been more to this run, but alas, the history books would say otherwise.
Well, I think they may have been going for, at some point, a Goldberg Warrior match, but I know Russo wanted to bring him back in 2000 and do that match, and then I'm surprised that nobody just slapped him and told him to leave after he suggested that. I just don't know what the thing was. I think he was in for, 2 months? And then he left again?
Yeah, a couple matches.
Yeah, I remember...
In and out.
I remember watching the Nitro where Warrior appeared. And I had no idea what was, what was going on. I was more of a WWF fan than I was a WCW fan.
Yeah.
And I would always watch the first hour of Nitro and then flip over to Raw as soon as Raw came on. And I remember watching this, and Warrior showing up, and I was shocked. I immediately called my buddy who was into wrestling. I said, "Hey, turn on Nitro, Warrior's on."
And yeah.
He was like, "Okay." He could have given a shit less about WCW, but it was a mind-boggling moment, because I remember right when I had started watching wrestling, Warrior had just come back to the WWF,
and then
disappeared for after 3 months, and then here he shows up in WCW 2 years later. I thought it was completely crazy.
Yeah, I mean, as a kid, he was a cultural touchstone. I mean, my brother one year for Halloween was dressed up like Warrior. I remember it well. And how all the reactions he got while we're out. And so, Warrior, is involved briefly here. Disciple Ed Leslie locks up the cage. This was kind of a cool moment, Adam, though, that they orchestrated for Warrior, is that he climbs up to kind of the top tier of the cage and then starts, kicking it like something you'd see out of an action movie, like you're escaping from, prison or something. And he kicks a portion of the cage out and is able to escape and catch, the hills as they scamper up the aisleway.
The sad thing is, that was the best part of the whole match.
Yeah.
That was the most entertaining thing in the whole match, seeing Warrior fight with that cage and try to get it busted open. I think was more entertaining than anything else that actually happened in the ring.
The big sloppy finish on this shit souffle is actually the botched ending, which is just, it's mind-bogglingly bad, Adam. Bret Hart holding Diamond Dallas Page,
mm-hmm.
and he's supposed to get slapjacked by Stevie Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And so Page is supposed to duck, though, and it's supposed to hit Bret. That's what was supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't quite work that way.
It doesn't.
So Paige, ducks on cue, but I don't know if Bret, flinched or didn't want to take the shot or just got confused. But Bret also ducks, and they both topple over awkwardly like the world's sweatiest Jenga game. And Stevie Ray hits neither man. It's so... just bizarre and such a and so then Paige pops up real quick and hits the diamond cutter and puts this to bed, and that's the finish. But man, did they ever mess up that slapjack spot there at the end.
That was bad. The whole thing was bad. Now here's a question. When Warrior showed up, Hogan and Stevie Ray were standing in the ring together. When Warrior left, Stevie Ray was down. How did Stevie Ray get down? Did Stevie Ray just pass out from all the smoke that was in the ring?
It could have been, or maybe one of the letters from his Aztecs had fallen off the back of his trunks and he had went to retrieve it.
Perhaps, yeah, it's one of those mysteries that will never be answered.
The L from Slapjack.
Slapjack. Right. No Sapjack.
Yeah, that's right. So, Adam, you know, even though there's all this star power and this was the main event of a major pay-per-view in the fourth quarter of 1998, I could only legitimately give this a 3 of 10.
I'm with you there. Yeah, a 3 of 10. I wrote, what a horrible match. Good candidate for the worst War Games match ever.
So much worse than I remembered.
Yeah, and I think even that one they did on Nitro in 2000 with Nash and Chronic and Sting and Jarrett and all them.
Yeah.
That was better and more entertaining than this.
They're both, I hoped I'd never have to watch either of those again. But
here's the thing, with all the star power in this match, it should have come across as a, you know, much better than it did. It was just...
Well, yeah, you got all these names. You got Sting and Warrior crossing paths, all these big stars.
Bret and Hook.
It should be a 5 easy and potentially, you know, higher, 6 or 7. And you think back to some of these great, you know, early, you know, War Games matches like 91 and whatnot, 92. And you can remember so much even, you know, all this time, you know, removed. But this match, you know, was just completely forgettable. Even your first act, which was Paige and Hart, which should have been a great introductory point to get things rolling, was just real bad, man. It was not good at all. It was a couple, you know, clotheslines, some sloppy work. Bret seemed to be elsewhere mentally, just not there. It did not sing at all. It didn't work.
It didn't. No, it was just bad. Everybody had mailed it in. They were worried about how much money they were just going to get paid.
And this is the representation that the producers of this DVD have selected for the New World Order. There was no other match that they would have rather have selected to show their prominence as arguably one of the greatest factions of all time.
Well, I can think of a bunch of other matches that they could have selected.
Well, sure. I mean, you could even put an outsider's tag. You know, they all fell under that umbrella of the New World Order.
Yeah, then they. I mean, you could have done. I think there was some outside. There was some Nash and Hall against Steiner's matches.
You could have even put a Nitro 6-man tag or something on here. I mean, other than this,
I remember they did. There was one time when Nash and Hall, right, came, I think it was towards the end of 96, it was Hall and Nash against Barbarian and Ming. They could have put that on there. That would have been
awesome. Make it.
Or even the match of the beach.
I want to distance ourselves from this match before it pulls us any further into the abyss.
Please.
So we're going to go ahead and look at match number 2, and Adam, the faction in question is the Brood.
Brood.
Do you have any fond memories of the Brood?
No. In Girls Music, and I like the fire ring they came up out of in the stage. That's all I remember of the Brood.
The match that they have selected for us, Adam, is the Brood, which is Edge, Christian, and Gangrel, their leader, that vamp, versus the Job Squad, made up of Al Snow, Bob Holly, and Scorpio. And this match came to us from Rock Bottom, which was December 13th, 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And 20,000 plus in Vancouver, so a big house. This was an in-your-house event.
This is like the next-to-last in-your-house event.
Yeah, good riddance. And before the match itself starts, Adam, during the you know, vignette on these guys,
mm-hmm.
Natalia says something so idiotic, just took her down a peg. She says, quote, "one of the greatest factions of all time," unquote.
No.
Yikes.
Well, the thing is, I didn't even remember that Edge and Christian were part of the Brood until this match came on the DVD.
I mean, her father was part of the Hart Foundation. How is she going to say that Gangrel and company and these two blonde goons? I mean, everybody loved the entrance. They talk about that, and the music is great. And at the time, I saw some of their work when JWB sent them down to IWA Puerto Rico, and some of that stuff was all right. But, I mean, let's not, you know, paint the past with false pretense. This is.
No, the thing is, too, and she was probably only. There was one of two ways she could have mentioned that. First, she was just reading off of a cue card or a teleprompter. Second, she only said that because Edge and Christian were in the match or in part of the Brood. Or the
yeah. One, maybe it's the Canadian connection.
Do you remember the New Brood? Gangrel and the Hardys?
Oh, yeah. That was extremely short-lived.
Yeah, I think for some reason that just popped in my mind. And then that was how we got to that ladder match. It was the New Brood against the Old Brood in the Tit.
Yeah, the Tit, man. The Terry Invitational Tournament. I imagine there's probably one being waged right now somewhere in Marietta in a bad, seedy, Motel 6.
I'm sure there is. I'm sure.
Two truck drivers are fighting for her.
Buff Bagwell's taking the bets.
So this match, Adam,
I liked this match.
It went 9 minutes, but they felt it pretty well.
Yeah.
But I wanna kind of riff here for a second, Adam.
Okay, go ahead.
What the fuck was the John Squad really? So what are they're losers?
Yeah.
Basically. I mean that's this, it's just so on the nose. Like, maybe in 90s we were all like trying to like be countercultural and look at these familiar, but it does not age well for me, this idea of these losers. We are losers. They got these t-shirts printed, Adam, a Job Squad shirt. It's got a little baby on the front. I think it's giving the middle finger or something. But there's this chubby little baby, newborn. And I hope the kid got royalties, man, for his college fund. He'd probably be coming of age now at this point, right. Some yeah. 16, 17 years later. But good God. So Michael Cole on commentary says a gothic lifestyle, quote unquote. And then later he refers to this goblet as a glass of that red liquid, he says, just really dancing around the issue there that it's blood. It's
yeah. The thing is too, and this was Cole's first major pay-per-view event. He was on commentary for it. He was filling in for JR at the time, who was out.
Yeah.
And I remember, and actually, right as the match started, he mentioned that the JR was out for medical reasons.
Yeah. Well, JR, you didn't miss much, man, that evening. Jerry Lawler had a good line. He called Bob Holly's new dye job, his hair was dyed blonde at this point. He called it a hair don't.
Yeah, I've heard that line numerous times from Lawler.
As opposed to a hairdo. I like that. So we talked about this match not being that bad, and I mean, I really got to just go ahead and say what made this match interesting for me was Too Cold Scorpio. He's one of my all-time favorite in-ring performers, like top five even, and he looked good. He looked fluid. He came in hot. He just has such a unique style that really stands out. And so at one point into the match, he did this somersault leg drop, which was like, wow, that's a spectacular move. You don't really see anybody doing it. And then later in the same match, and this is just completely bonkers, he tops himself as if he's playing, like a game of one-upsmanship with himself. Instead of doing the somersault leg drop, he climbs to the top turnbuckle and does a moonsault leg drop onto Christian.
Oh, that was awesome.
Go ahead and rewind it. A moonsault leg drop. I don't know that that had ever been done before or since. It doesn't even make any sense in terms of gravity.
I don't think I've ever seen anybody do that ever
before. I mean, it's such a hard... because you pretty much fling yourself. Like, there's no really clean way to hit it. Scorpio's the only guy in modern era, especially on the big platforms like WWF and WCW, to attempt such ballsy, creative aerial maneuvers, and for that, I thank him. And that's why I inducted him years back in the NHO Hall of Fame.
Scorpio was by far the MPV of this match, I thought.
There was an extended Edge headlock on Al Snow, and the crowd went mild.
Yeah. I liked the DDT that Gangrel hit on Al Snow. And did you notice that Lawler spent the whole match just shitting on the Job Squad?
Yeah, he did. And maybe that kind of helped bring it to my attention, too. I mean, it is such a strange thing. Like, how do you want to look at this? Do you want to look at it from like a insider perspective? Well, that kind of drains the fun out of things, you know. Okay, do you want to look at it from a kayfabe perspective? Like, you know, try to get lost and get into these characters. Well, either way you cut it, you know, they're calling attention to the fact that they're losers, and it's just it's a weird. Like, I don't know how that got pitched, and somebody said, yeah, like, let's go with that. It's just a little too insidery, you know, too tongue-in-cheek. It's like a one-off joke that could have been done, like, once, one night, one taping, but the fact that they tried to stretch it out, paper thin.
It's like the fact that it was a completely random team of Al Snow, Scorpio, and Bob Holly.
I mean, you have these kind of, the equivalent to, like, actors would be like character actors. You had these kind of traveling guys who had been up and down the road, and yeah, it was a nice, you know, hodgepodge and odd assortment of talent, but that label's the death knell. I mean, you're not going to get a guy going for the gold or drawing or working semi-main as a representative of the Job Squad, you know?
I think the Job Squad was disbanded shortly thereafter.
Yes.
If I remember right, that Snow and Holly had started feuding over the hardcore title.
Yeah. Christian hit the Impaler on Scorpio, and I asked, why, God, why did it not happen to Bob Holly? But Scorpio takes the loss for his team at 9 minutes. And at one point, too, you mentioned Gangrel a moment ago. Edge sprung off Gangrel's back onto everybody out on the floor. That was another cool spot. Yeah, this was quite fun. And I gave it 4, and that was because of Scorpio. Had he not been involved, I mean, this could have, you know, just been a TV, you know, Sunday Night Heat, you know, opener.
Yeah.
For me, but
5 on this one. I like the whole thing. The action was fast and paced. There wasn't a whole lot of downtime. A bunch of the stuff they were doing at the time, like springboard dives, Scorpio's wild high flying, had never really been done in the WWF, so it made the crowd pop huge for it. Scorpio was really good. I think everybody, you know, did fairly well in this match. So it was a fun opener. It was actually the opener of that particular pay-per-view, so got the crowd going, did what it was supposed to do. So, you know, yeah, I think a 5 here is pretty sufficient.
Okay. I'll bite. Up next, we're going to move back in time to 1994, Survivor Series of that year, November 23rd.
Oh, this is the match I've been looking forward to discussing the most.
Oh, okay.
Because I've got nearly 2 paragraphs written on this.
Well, let's see. It was from the Freeman Coliseum in San Antonio, about 10,000 people on deck. And before I get into the combatants themselves, I want to tell you guys what faction this is. And it's the Million Dollar Corporation, Adam.
Yeah, I was always a fan of the Million Dollar Corporation. I always enjoyed them.
It's such a strange faction. It's kind of like C players. You know, you've got Nikolai Volkoff, but instead of dollar signs, he's got the cent symbol on his trunks.
Yeah.
It was kind of, you know, basically all these scrubs that DiBiase could buy up and kind of use as his lackeys. Kind of like this comical villain, you know.
It was a odd assortment of characters, yes, but I think it worked well. I think it was a really good faction for the, at least in that time period of WWF.
Yeah, I think time specific, yeah, they were nice foils to some of the mid-card faces. And it was nice for us to see some familiar faces given a little bit of new life. Again, guys like Volkoff and even King Kong Bundy. This match is a traditional Survivor Series elimination match, and you get that million-dollar team representing the corporation of Tatanka, Bam Bam Bigelow, King Kong Bundy, and the Heavenly Bodies, fresh out of Smoky Mountain Wrestling, against a team of Guts and Glory, also known as Guts and Glory Hall. By me and my friends back then. But you got Lex Luger, Adam Bomb, Mabel, and the Smoking Guns.
If you look at this on paper, It's just a completely random pairing of 10 people. If you didn't know what was going on at the time, and you just looked at that match based on, you know, not knowing any of the factions or anything, you'd just say, this is a complete random, thrown-together 10-man tag elimination match.
You look at this, it's jumbled together. It's a kaleidoscope of kitsch.
It is.
You know? And actually, the first thing that I thought of once the match got underway and all 10 men were on the apron, I said, this looks like a bad costume party.
Yeah, that's true. It does.
You know?
Mabel's got, you know, Mabel in his PJs, smoking guns. It's like a bad Halloween party, yeah.
Yeah, you've got Billy and Bart in these, like, beige Wranglers.
Yeah.
And you got this purple, you know, tablecloth on Mabel.
You've got
Mr.
Bob-omb from Mario Brothers.
Yeah, you've just got so much going on here. Very colorful, if nothing else.
Yep.
And so Tatanka and Lex got us underway to start. And right off the bat, I was just taken back to a year or two ago. I couldn't stop thinking of Tatanka when he performed at the Chikara King of Trios shows. I watched that not too long ago, and obviously now he's not as mobile and a bit more bulky, but it's nice that he's still doing his thing.
Yeah, you know, speaking of that real quick,
mm-hmm.
Did you like any of those matches that he did on those shows?
I didn't hate them.
Yeah, I really did not like the one he did. I think it was like the singles match he did on night two.
It
was bad.
Yeah, I don't know if I got that night under my belt yet. I think I've just seen the first night. So, yeah. Did he work Sugar Dunkleton?
Something like that. Yeah, I think that's who he worked.
Okay. Really? Yeah, I could see that one being maybe a bit rough around the edges. But
It was a little rough. But anyway.
Lex is a house of fire early, Adam, until he struggles getting Jimmy Del Rey, the gigolo himself, up to press him on to one of his partners.
Yeah.
That was a little sloppy.
The Luger Tatanka start was kind of sloppy too.
You've got the purple elephant though in the room, Adam, and that's the wrongful death of Frazier himself, Mabel. Recently, allegations have been made in a court case. Has came to light. His wife, in mourning, is suing WWE. Recent headline I called, but
well, here's the thing with that. And forgive me for going on a tangent here, but he wrestled. That's what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, I guess the basis of this whole thing is that he suffered brain damage from wrestling or something like that. Is that what I got out of it?
I haven't actually looked into the details.
Basically, the whole gist is it's a wrongful death lawsuit placed by Mabel's widow on the WWE on the fact that he died too young. Well, here's two things. One, he was a professional wrestler. Okay, that was his chosen occupation. It is not a not like sitting behind a desk for eight or 9 hours a day, you know, 5 days a week. The other thing is that, you know, no offense to the man, but the dude weighed 500 pounds.
Oh, I mean, he was bulbous.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
He was an obese beast.
Yeah, and he was, what, 6'8", easy?
Yeah.
He was not a small person. So those two factors right there, to me, it just doesn't, you know, it just sounds very frivolous.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, obviously his health was a major concern, and that's what I always assumed. I guess I never really followed up on his cause of death. I assumed it was probably heart, you know, related or, you know, health related. But one of the interesting things about him in this match is that when he stands across the ring from Bam Bam Bigelow, it makes Bam Bam Bigelow look like the size of a normal man.
That's true.
We often think of Bigelow as this big guy, but he looked positively normal.
Yep.
Compared to Mabel.
Just to go back to Mabel here, it was a heart attack.
Yeah, which, you know.
4 days, you know, after, 4 days after he turned 40, so actually just about a year ago.
Yeah, I saw some of his stuff from All Japan around 2011 or so, and you know, it was moderately good, but nothing, you know, blow your skirt up.
Yep.
But I've always been a big fan of his, and he was pretty good in this match. Maybe not as good as, you know, Bigelow or some of the other guys. But you know who actually looked really good, Adam? And he wasn't in the ring for very long, but I was very impressed because I always kind of thought of this guy as more of a hanger-on, like a guy that had a limited skill set and just kind of rode the coattails of other people, including his idols like Piper. Tom Pritchard was quite good in his short run in this. He threw a really nice knee drop. He bumped and just moved around the ring well. He got crushed though by Mabel, and was the first man eliminated.
Yeah, I mean Pritchard. I mean the Heavenly Bodies actually they were a pretty good team. They hung around the WWF for a while.
Yeah.
He hung around Smoky Mountain for a while. I know Cornette really liked having them around there. Basically, I think because they were solid workers.
I always thought of Pritchard more as this, you know, the loudmouth character. I always kind of put him in the same boat as I did, like, somebody like, you know, Mike Sanders or some of these guys that were just talkers that weren't really wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, he looked good in here. Maybe I probably need to go back and look at some more Pritchard stuff. I might be surprised.
I actually just watched a Tom Pritchard-Terry Taylor match, and it's on that Brian Pillman Memorial Show review I just posted.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And it was a really good match. Pritchard and Terry Taylor from the Cincinnati Gardens. That's definitely one to go check out if you want to see a good Tom Pritchard match.
Yeah, I might go back and look at some of his Texas stuff, too. There was a really cool spot where there was these dueling rolling kicks by Mabel and Bam Bam Bigelow, two big men known for their athleticism. And then this was just nuts to me, Adam. Mabel scales the turnbuckle and goes up top and takes that patented Ric Flair bump where you get slammed from the top buckle in the corner. That was pretty hurdy. Big impact.
Yeah, and then Mabel and Bigelow, they crashed to the floor, and I'm pretty sure I felt my house shake.
Oh, before that crazy spill, there was one other thing of note, though, is that Bam Bam, not to be outdone, also goes to the top. And he tries to sunset flip Mabel, which was just such an unnecessary move. Because what happens is he basically somersaults and takes a flat back bump from about 9 foot in the air. Doesn't, of course, not, you know, graceful enough as like a Matt Sydal or an AJ Styles. Doesn't grab Mabel, not to mention that Mabel weighs 500 pounds.
Yeah.
So the move does not come off clean or at all. But then, yeah, shortly after, Mabel does this clothesline to Bigelow, and yeah, that spill to the floor was just wow.
That was
they replayed it in slow motion, and it looked dangerous. Like it looked like an accident, like a car crash. It didn't look like a rehearsed wrestling spot.
No, no, yeah, it was nasty, and it's definitely worth. I mean, this whole match is definitely. I think it's a lot of fun. The whole thing.
I did until about this point. The last part of it, it kind of left me a little dry, left me a little cold. But at this point, I was still on board. Adam Baum got involved. He threw punches that looked like a guy playing frisbee golf. I did like his outfit, though. Like typically, when I think of Adam Baum, I think of that very red and yellow kind of his trademark, you know, outfit. But this outfit was like a neon yellow, almost Ryback-esque.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, you know, eye-catching. And then, Adam, I want to talk real fast about Bam Bam Bigelow's moonsault, because he busts one out here, and I've never been a fan of it. I know that the idea of this mountain of a man doing the moonsault is supposed to be special, but he always kind of – he never goes, you know – hills overhead, basically. He never does an actual back flip. He kind of does this sideways, almost cartwheel in air.
Yeah.
Which I'll call it a moonsault in air quotations with my fingers. And in fact, Adam, I've went ahead and redubbed it. I've named it tonight.
Oh.
From now on, the Bam Bam Bigelow moonsault will be called the Apple Turnover.
Apple Turnover.
Because he turns over in midair, it's not a real moonsault.
It's a very unique moonsault, unique looking moonsault, and he's the only one that kind of does that turn in midair. Whereas everybody else, if you look at a Vader moonsault, it's a picture perfect moonsault.
Yeah.
And actually, there was a I just watched an interview with Vader recently, and it's actually the Timeline 93 WCW video. And he's talking about the fact that Bigelow was promoted. I think it might have been in WCW, but I think I could be wrong. He may have mentioned it about when he was talking briefly about WWF. But Bam Bam Bigelow was promoted as the first big man ever to do a moonsault. And which Vader came out and flatly stated was inaccurate.
Yeah.
Because he was the first big man to do a moonsault, at least in WCW or in the WWF. Now in Japan, that title could go to anybody, but at least in the WWF or WCW, he said he was the first one to do it. And he actually pointed to the event was Beach Blast 93, where he was the first... first big man like that to do a moonsault from the top rope. But anyway,
you know, there was this one time, there was a down in Shreveport, at a chili parlor, Ernie Ladd slipped, on some food and did a moonsault. So I think he was actually the first man to own that title.
Is that on the Best of Mid-South?
Just the exclusive, you know, director's cut. You got to send in 5 proof of purchase points to receive that special disc. So Adam, this is when the match kind of lost me here. When the smoking guns take over the ship. They get behind the driving wheel and just screeches to a halt. So this time it's not Thanks Obama, it's Thanks Smoking Guns.
Do you remember real quick anything good from Tatanka's comeback in 06?
Yeah.
Elaborate.
I think, and I could be wrong because this is completely on the spot, but if I'm not mistaken, he had a good match on SmackDown against Matt Hardy, I want to say.
I don't remember anything from that time. Or at least his comeback.
I don't know if he worked Angle or not, or was Angle still there, but I'm pretty sure Matt Hardy and him had a good match. And
didn't he come back and he did for about 6 weeks he did his Native American thing, and didn't he turn heel and start doing face paint and stuff?
Yeah, no, there was a metamorphosis of his character, for sure.
Then he just disappeared, didn't he?
Yeah, he wasn't around real long, but it was nice to see him, I think, but it was short-lived.
Yeah, it was. But yeah, you mentioned the smoking guns there. I said Bart and Tatanka had an extremely awkward setup and execution on a Samoan drop. And then Bundy came in, just looking like a bowling ball with a head.
Yeah.
And smashed everybody. But yeah, the smoking guns here, when they took over, you're right, it was not good.
I mean, that's when the match kind of dropped off for me. You mentioned that run of Tatanka's, but I'm actually going back to his original run, and I've referenced in the past previous projects that we've accomplished in the past on Never Hand Over, and me and the guys did a Superstars 96 project, and I was trying to scroll through the rankings of that entire year of TV to see if any of Tatanka's matches, you know, kind of made the cut, and...
Well, that was Tatanka's last year, too. He wasn't around much in 96.
Yeah, it looks like he had one match that made our top 25 list, and it was number 20 on our list. It was against Savio Vega from March 30th of that year.
Yeah, he wasn't around much after that. I think he might have appeared on a couple episodes of Raw.
Uh-huh.
But after that, I think he was gone.
Yeah, short shrift.
Yeah. What was your thoughts on the ending of this match? Because I thought it was just completely too long.
Well, yeah, I mean, the ending was another problem that I had with it. I almost, do I need to rewind it? Did I miss something? Because it all happened so abruptly. It was hasty, and it wasn't done cleanly. Lex stumble bumbles. He tries to do a roll-up on Tatanka. Mm-hmm. It looks terrible. Tatanka had been, you know, kind of a hot hand the whole match as a heel, and gets, you know, kind of looks foolish getting rolled up by this oaf. Lex Luger, and then, you know, King Kong Bundy hits a quick splash and that wraps it up. I mean, kudos to Bundy. I mean, great win for him on a big platform. Not that it did anything for his career, but I mean, he got the clean victory over, you know, Lex Luger. But yeah, I mean, it was definitely a flat finish.
Yeah, well, that for the 3-on-1 part of it, right at the end, it just felt like it went on forever until they got to that roll up and that splash. For me, my mind was wandering when I was watching
At
it. It's like, are there better things I can be doing with this 4 minutes or 5 minutes of my life?
Adam, let me take you into the time machine for a second, brother. June 7th, 2006, you, I, and our friend Tim were in Dayton, Ohio at the ECW versus WWE head-to-head show.
Yes.
And before the televised, excuse me, what I'm trying to say is before the televised portion of the night's festivities, there were a couple dark matches, and one of them happened to be Jimmy Yang versus Tatanka.
I remember this now. And the
Yes.
first time we saw Jimmy Yang and the redneck cowboy get up, and all three of us looked at each other and we just started laughing. And we were like, what the fuck is this?
Well, your comments, I actually have your review pulled up from almost a decade ago. You
Oh no.
said the match blew harder than Stephanie. And I got some Dippin'
Oh.
Dots ice cream.
I don't remember this. Yeah, the match must have been bad then.
But no, you know, I mentioned the Warrior and that kind of lost run of his in WCW. I love these little lost runs. I love one of my favorite things in watching and having this wealth of material at our disposal is looking at things kind of objectively, you know, through a lens. And you know, the 2006 run of Tatanka is one that might be, you know, worthy of look. I mean, him and Matt Hardy teamed up at No Way Out 2006 against Eminem. So he got a pay-per-view
Well, that year.
payday.
And I was not objective. Speaking of it, I was not, must have not been objective when I made that comment about that match.
Well, yeah, I mean,
Was completely non-objective.
well, you call him like you see him, but I you know, at the time though, you know, that's but I'm saying like now we
Yeah.
can look back removed and say, well, you know, I don't remember that very well, or you know, like was it any good? And I think there's some, you know, merit in that.
Yeah, I think I need to probably go back and watch some of these SmackDown. If these SmackDowns from 06 ever show up on the network, then I'll go back and watch them. But I don't have any of them on tape or DVD. But I just because I probably would like to dive into Tonka's 06 comeback run, just see if there was any other hidden gems in there, like you
I
mentioned.
mean, 06 SmackDown was probably one of my favorite years of that brand. And so yeah, I'm sure there's some other stuff that I'm forgetting. I think I don't have any data or any information on this to further clarify, but I feel like Jesse, NHL co-founder, and I watched some weird WWE 24/7 back before the network existed. Special about a tour that they had done in, I think, New Zealand or something.
Was it the New Zealand? Yeah, I think I'm. Didn't they do like a house show or something on there?
Yeah, and it actually aired on that 24/7, and I'm pretty sure Tatanka was on that.
Me see if I can find the lineup of that real quick. Give me just a minute here to research. So that was 06, right?
Yeah, Adam, another match that maybe we can point people towards is there's a Gregory Helms Tatanka match from August 11th, 2006 on SmackDown. Another one maybe worth
Round to
a
August?
look at. Yeah, he took on Sylvain Grenier also in August. Probably you can skip that one safely.
Okay, yeah, here's the show you were talking about.
Okay, yeah, I'm dying to
March
know. I
06, Wellington, New Zealand, Westpac Stadium. So we have Gregory Helms versus Noble versus Kid Cash. Sylvain Grenier against Sho Funaki. London and Kendrick against Eminem. Matt Hardy against Road Warrior Animal. Lashley versus Finlay. Orlando Jordan versus Boogeyman. Benoit versus Booker T. Randy Orton versus Rey Mysterio. And Kurt Angle versus Mark Henry versus The Undertaker. No sign of Tatanka, unfortunately.
No. I thought maybe me and Jesse reviewed that back then, but I couldn't find any evidence of that. But yeah, so the match, Adam, it did not end well. It lost a lot of the good faith that it had built up in me. Had it kind of kept at the clip it was early in the match, this could have been a kind of a surprise hit. But as it was, I gave this a 4.
I gave it a 5, just because I thought it was a lot of fun. Just because it's one of those mid-90s WWF matches you're only going to get in that time period. All these wacky characters, all these wacky storylines. It's
You
really
know, I know it's a
fun
soft
for me.
spot for you, that mid-90s nostalgia,
Yeah,
so.
that's kind of the stuff I enjoy watching from time, if I need to go back and watch something just for noise, I'll throw something on from that time period.
Well, I think switching gears, we're gonna get a little edgier, Adam. We're gonna go to the Attitude Era for our next match. We're gonna be looking at the faction, the Nation of Domination. And the match that they have selected from the Nation is Owen Hart, Kama Mustafa, and D'Lo Brown versus Triple H and the New Age Outlaws. This took place at Over the Edge, May 31st, 1998.
Milwaukee.
9,800 in the crowd.
Yep. And
And I just want to point out the documentary portion before this. You got a lot of people talking about, the impact and the resonance of this faction and kind of maybe being a bit ahead of its time or button pushing. And but there was no mention of Owen Hart, which I found odd during the whole documentary portion. He's included in the match, of course, but I would have liked to seen him, showcase as well as some of these other members who did get some time, like Mustafa. And,
Yeah, this is a match I really like, honestly.
It's probably, if we're gonna go ahead and go there, it's probably my highest rated of the six that we will be tackling today.
me too.
So to get underway, Triple H gets the microphone, of course, and he asks Milwaukee if they were ready to suck it. Okay.
Let's move along.
My first thought as this match came on and lit up my screen and the shadows in the dark, as it were, in my room, one of these things is not like the other. I kept thinking about the Nation of Domination. So JR at one point proposes that, quote, Gunn, in reference to the badass Billy Gunn, he's an athletic specimen, quote. And then he says, he's a horse, end quote. So which
Sports.
is it, Adam? Is he a centaur? Is he a manitar? Like, is he? Well, that's a centaur, right? Half man, half
An
horse.
athletic specimen that's a horse. So is he a horse?
Yeah, he's one of those centaurs from like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Okay.
All right. We'll go.
Well,
Let's just go with that, I suppose.
throw a saddle on him and ride him hard, I guess.
Yeah, they rode him for what, 10 years? 12 years?
Well, what was so stupid was a couple, weeks or months back when you drag out all these old acts for like a reunion Raw, and it's PG now, so you got the Road Dogg on the microphone, and he can't say badass, God forbid. So he says the bad guy, Billy Gunn. A little bit of my soul died that night. So there's a
My
at
soul
one
died
point.
every time Road Dogg gets on the mic, and he's a 45, nearly 50-year-old man, probably doing shtick he did in 98. My soul just dies.
I mean,
It's
I'm not trying to be contrarian, but if we're looking at in-ring output alone, I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and say his work under the Voodoo Kin Mafia in TNA trumps his offerings in the beloved DX.
Yeah, I'm
And
with
if
you.
you and if you want to take me to task for that, by all means, we can dovetail into some Road Dogg conversations. But going back to this match, Adam, a sharpshooter attempt was blocked by Billy Gunn using an eye poke. And there you get China out on the floor. And in my second Terminator reference of the night, Adam, she was wearing some Terminator-inspired S&M gear. Just a really heinous outfit on China. Really
Yeah.
just kind of churned my stomach.
Never was a big fan of China.
Same here. So, Adam, I'm going to propose a question to you.
Okay.
Lawler randomly states out of nowhere, quote, X-Pac is cool, unquote. You agree?
Well, that seems like it's very out of context. Lawler just randomly saying, Xbox is cool. You know, I can probably see them saying that in between ranting about puppies and whatnot. I don't know. I just really wasn't... Yeah, he was good in the... Yeah, I mean, he was all right in DX. X-Factor, no, I wanted him to go away. I'm going to go with no on this one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess anybody that has a bad ladder match, Eddie Guerrero, you probably get a point knocked against you.
Yeah, well, the thing is, too, like...
But the question is, you know, I mean, is he a good worker? I'll buy and say, yeah, you know, I think he is. But the question that Lawler, you know, suggests is he cool? And that's a whole other can of worms.
He tries to act cool. Is he cool? Probably not.
Well, not now with the, you know, drug addiction and the hepatitis.
He wears a headband every time. Like, if you saw the Hall of Fame last year? He had the tuxedo on and he had the stupid headband.
Well, you know, it's I think it's Hep C, right? It's hepatitis C. There's a reason he can't work, you know, that Trips and Nash can't get him a job working in developmental down in Florida where he lives because he's got hepatitis. But anyhow, sorry to kick some extra dirt onto the open grave of one Sean Waltman. So en route to Daybreak, four shirtless Team Mels are seen in the crowd, Adam, with the most strange chest paintings I've seen this side of Kamala's moon boobs. The four teenage men have on their chest, the first has the letter S, the third has the letter C, and the fourth has the letter K. Now, you might be assuming that the second one had the letter U, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the letter O for sock, but no, he has an asterisk.
Sock it, or sock.
The second guy has an asterisk on his chest, Adam. So four guys literally drove there. I don't know if they pre-painted or did it in the parking lot or maybe in the bathroom. Why they, you know. But anyway, S.
I can imagine the guy with the asterisk in the shower the next day, getting ready for work, trying to scrub that off, being, damn it, this shit won't come off.
Yeah, he's reaching into the, you know, to the fridge to grab a, you know, some grapefruit juice on his way to work or school, and his mom walks in and why is there an asterisk on your chest?
Don't ask.
Well, Mom, it's better than Aztecs.
better than Aztecs.
So, comma, Jerry, you know, Lawler is not sorry, Lawler, but Ross. I meant to say, is very great about, you know, painting in these backstories of the wrestlers and stuff. And at one point, he says, comma is studying Thai boxing. And my thought, Adam, was it looks like he's eating too much Thai food.
Maybe. Thai boxing.
There was a sick pile driver by Owen on Road Dogg. Freaking loved it.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite pile drivers, you know, Owen Hart.
Yeah, I knew that too. Style. I know that probably ruined Road Dogg's night.
It sure made mine. And then JR, another odd call, as Owen Hart does an elbow drop from the second buckle. JR says, an elbow drive.
I missed that one.
Did he get confused? Is that like the street that he lived on, elbow drive? He's so used to telling the taxi guy, because, you know, take me to 440, elbow drive.
Is it like
elbow drive?
Is it like
elbow drive?
Is it like the elbow room that's right around the corner from your house?
Yeah, good place to have a pint.
Yeah.
And, you know, snotter off, but...
snotter off.
You know... I guess that would be the question, the Ross. Are you trying to take the piss if we're throwing around Brit slang? But anyhow, Road Dogg, there was a lot of quotes from this match. Maybe it was just the attitude commentary stuck out more so than the other matches that I've seen on this set leading up to this point. There's just so many one-liners that they're spitting out. Lawler says, Road Dogg, maybe roadkill soon. Well... possibly. And as he says this, the cameraman actually gets this close-up of the four-lane interstate-sized back of China.
No.
Randomly.
No.
Takes us there.
Yeah.
JR says Bob Marley like dreadlocks in reference to Road Dogg.
Okay.
D'Lo Brown does a moonsault and then a Dick Togo-like back senton, which misses. You know, brown, quite athletic,
Yep.
green around the ears, and
What?
I don't know if he ever, I don't know if he ever really shucked that chartreuse color. Maybe he worked it into a fine, you know, olive green, but he was always a little rough.
Yeah. Did you catch that stiff power bomb that he hit Road Dogg with?
Oh, no doubt.
Oh, that was crazy. That was
And
probably
then you get Triple H and Billy Gunn do a spike pile driver onto the belt on one of the Nation members. But the end of the match is interesting, Adam, and it was kind of a pleasant surprise. Owen uses a pedigree on Triple H onto the belt for the finish at 18 minutes and 33 seconds. Kind of cool seeing Owen break out, you know, a pedigree here. Kind of a nice little way to throw a little salt into the wound. It was cool to see the Nation of Domination actually on the winning side of the column for once. And Adam, I gave this a 5.
I gave this a 7.
Wow.
Yeah, I noted here that the crowd, you know, the crowd was going absolutely apeshit for everything. And to me, having the crowd go crazy for stuff, pretty much a whole match, I mean, that adds a lot of value to a match for me.
Yeah.
Comet just he destroyed everybody he came in contact with. The Nation was taunting DX, with D'Lo jawing at Triple H, Owen doing the crotch chop and just being a complete jackass. I thought everything was pretty crisp and had a good quick pace. The ending was a little eh for me, but hey, it worked, so I'm not going to complain too much. But yeah, a match like this, to me, it reminds me of why I dig the hell out of a good 6-man tag.
Yeah, I'm with you.
So yeah, I got to give this a 7. This was a lot of fun. This is probably a match I would recommend. As soon as you finish listening to this show, look it up on YouTube, or heck, if you have the DVD set while you're listening to this, pop it in, watch it, and tell us what you think. We'd love to hear about it.
Well, hey, you know, I'll do you one better and say get on the WWE Network, and a couple clicks away, you'll have it at your disposal.
The Edge 98.
Your laptop, cell phone, or on your big screen. Yep. Speaking about your big screen, Adam, where a better place to watch this next match than on the biggest screen you can find? And I'm talking about Big Stevie Cool versus Axel Rotten from ECW Hardcore TV, January 7th of 1997. We are looking at, of course, the Blue World Order, baby. On the same disc as the NWO, we get the BWO.
No. I didn't get into ECW until they came on TNN. I think I've mentioned this before. So I wasn't too familiar with the BWO. My first exposure to them was when I bought the tape of Barely Legal when it was released in stores by Pioneer Video, I think it was. Bought it from Suncoast, brought it home, popped it in. And I see these dudes running around in blue shirts calling themselves the BWO. I'm thinking, well, that's just a ripoff. So I never really got the whole BWO thing. I guess I was late to the party on it. But this match wasn't good. I didn't like this at all.
Well, I'll say the video segment, the vignette that precedes the match, is probably one of the better ones on the entire 3-disc set because it does give you a little glimpse into this faction. And even though I was and am familiar with them, there was a lot of neat little moments on that vignette that kind of made me chuckle. You know, there's a lot of odd characters in this faction because it's actually quite immersive. There's some fringe players. And my favorite oddity of this group was always 7-Eleven, which was, you know, RF Video's own Rob Feinstein.
I was getting ready to ask, wasn't Rob Feinstein involved with this?
But the one that I had forgotten about, Adam, and this DVD reminded me and got a big grin on my face, was the Inchworm. Yes, BWO, just like the NWO, had the Worm, Dennis Rodman, among their ranks. The BWO had their own Dennis Rodman, the Inchworm.
Who was that? When
just some guy with a bad Cisco dye job. Some like 100 and maybe 30-pound crackhead was from South Philly.
Yeah,
honestly,
I don't ever remember him ever getting a match. So,
this match, Adam, it's short, but jumping into what little meat there is on this,
there's no meat here whatsoever.
Axel at this point was not too obese here. He was rocking the Marilyn Manson shirt and the plaid shorts. not too dissimilar from the uniform that he wore on the ECW action figure of his I actually owned.
Yeah. Here's what I wrote. Noticed Axel choking Stevie at one point. Nowadays, he probably couldn't even choke his chicken without getting winded.
Holy cow.
Axel's shirt says, believe in the back. Believe in what, Axel? Shitty singles matches?
Oh, Chavo. Stevie Richards, after raining down some punches at him at one point, started skull-fucking Axel. But the dick and the phallic humor was not to be outdone at that point. There was more to follow. But before that, Adam, I noticed bright lights. And if ever there was a crowd that needed to be dimmed, it was the ECW crowd. And this crowd was lit better than the ring. And I don't know if this was Hammerstein or the Manhattan Center. This was one of those, you know, New York ballrooms masquerading as in a wrestling arena.
It's like a random gym somewhere. Because that's what it looked like to me. Like some gym club.
Yeah, I wasn't sure where this was. But getting back to the groin humor, Axel does this jumping soccer kick to the groin. And then both guys headbutt each other in the junk. The one thing that made me kind of stand up and take attention, Adam, is that Axel does the Dominator. Funny, we just talked about the Nation of Domination. Farouk's, his finish, just kind of front layout suplex still. Mm-hmm. It looked very violent and kind of, like I said, I did pop on it. He pulls him up. He makes a second attempt. It's countered to a Stevie kick. Mm-hmm. Those rarely land, both physically and emotionally to me as a viewer. This didn't stir up a lot of feelings, but I didn't find it terribly off-putting. I didn't grade it apparently at the time, but from memory, I would give this a 3.
Yeah, I'm with you on the same boat there. This just, it really had no meat here. It was just kind of to me, it just felt like a nothing match.
I want to just go back to, you know, the segment with them beforehand is maybe better than the match by all means. There's a clip of them like on the streets somewhere in Manhattan and they super kick Santa, you know. That was a lot of fun. I don't think I'd ever seen that particular clip.
Did you notice too during this match that it would go back from like it would switch back and forth from a regular camera to what looked like a fan cam? And they kind of switch back and forth like that.
Yeah, that was pretty customary, I think, at that time for them on Hardcore TV.
That kind of detracted from the match, too, I thought. It's like, okay, pick one and stay with it.
Well, I was so used to that point, to that kind of shaky, staticky ringside camera from all the fan cams I used to order from RF Video, that it didn't really catch me off guard. But we go from that kind of fringe setting and in place in the history books to something a lot more polished and commercial. Mm-hmm. We look at the corporation, Adam.
And we could have found 10,000 better matches to represent the corporation than this, I think.
Yep.
I think any match from this era could have represented the corporation better. The corporate Royal Rumble we talked about on the last podcast, on this first disc, would have represented the corporation better than this.
Yeah.
This was an absolutely, I don't even know if this was officially, I don't even know what this was.
Well, it was called a corporate gauntlet match, Adam, and it pitted Stone Cold Steve Austin, the world's hottest wrestler at that time, and maybe of all time, versus the corporation. Mm-hmm. And this was from an episode of Raw, February 13th, 1999. So
special Saturday Raw.
Yeah, go ahead and snuggle up with your sweetheart and kick back to this. Adam, I watched the match on YouTube, actually, because the TV was being used by a family member, mm-hmm. and my disk drive and my laptop is shot. And so I took to the interwebs and surfed for free and watched a nice pixelated cut of this match. And I don't think that it detracted at all from my enjoyment. One thing of note, Adam, is that, and I don't know if you picked up on this, being a bit of a historian and a fan of the arenas, Correct me if I'm wrong, but this was in the Sky Dome?
This was in the Sky Dome,
This
yes.
was in a freaking huge, like, this was I mean, a giant platform for Monday Night Raw, maybe one of the biggest ever.
Yeah, you'd
And
never
you
see
put
Raw
this,
from Sky
you
Dome
put,
before.
I mean, you put this at the top of the show. This is how you send the fans home happy. Yikes.
It was this. There were two Raws from Sky Dome in '99. There was this, and there was one in October. And what was the main event? The main event was, I can't remember what the main event was from the one in October. I know JR was involved in it.
You remember that Raw from, oh, I don't know, 6, 7 years ago with that was in Japan?
Barely.
I think Triple H, of course, booked himself up top in some clunker of a main event singles match.
I barely remember that show.
I want to say that they brought out at least one credible name from Japan for the event, but somebody under roster, maybe like a Tajiri or a Taka. But anyhow, anything's more interesting and thought-provoking and kind of opening up those channels in our brain, slipping down the rabbit hole of wrestling fandom, than actually talking about this. But it's our duty as we finished off disc two to cover it. And so, Adam, I'm just going to tell you my thoughts. Number one,
Very
Ken
quickly,
Shamrock.
sorry to cut you off, but very quickly before that, I mentioned there were two Raws from Sky Dome in '99. I was wrong. The one in October was from the Georgia Dome, and it had
Oh.
the main event was Steve Austin and Jim Ross against Triple H in China.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, right? It
God,
wasn't.
I feel like you just stuck a shiv in my side.
The main event actually was Rock and Mankind against Val Venus and British Bulldog.
I mean, were they just trying to be audacious? Like, you booked the Sky Dome and the Georgia Dome and you put that shit up top?
I don't know what they were thinking.
Like,
You also had the same show. You had a Hojack match. I don't even know what that is.
oh,
They had Chris Jericho and Mr. Hughes against the Headbangers.
this a fever dream?
Probably.
My Mr.
Yes.
Hughes, give me my American Wrestling Federation, my AWF, that era Mr. Hughes, I'm on board with, but the Gotch Gracie stuff, not so much. So yeah, let's go ahead and close this out by looking at this pile of shit called
Okay.
the Corporate Gauntlet match. Shamrock got caught off guard, Adam, like the time Frank walked into his bedroom when they were teenagers. Ken Shamrock, for having such a long athletic career, seemed incredibly uncoordinated.
Hey, while we're on the topic of Shamrock, have you watched that Shamrock documentary? It's on Fight Pass.
No, the fightography?
Yeah, the fight. Yeah, no, the Pioneers of MMA.
Oh, okay. No, I
That
have not seen it.
watched that the other night. It's really, really. It's only 30 minutes, but it's really, really good.
Yeah, for
Worth.
all of you network WWE that is only subscribers out there, we do say check out UFC Fight Pass because there's some really great stuff on it, both for current fans, historic fans. But you know, I will take that look. I did watch. I didn't finish it actually. I think I got about 2/3 through the Sakuraba doc that they put up, which I think also runs about 30, 40 minutes.
And the funny thing is, too, when they talk when on the Shamrock documentary, they mention his run. They talk about his run in WWF.
Yeah, I think
It's
that.
in passing, but they mention the WWF by name.
And I think they launched another one of those, actually, if I'm not mistaken, this very week, one on Vitor Belfort.
Oh, really? Well,
Yeah, so,
now.
but again, anything to pull us away from this match. So, Adam, when you asked, like, could this even be called a match? Like, what is this? Like, I can't run through and say, well, yeah, it was a gauntlet, and this is how this fall ended, this is how this fall ended, because every single fall. Besides the last fall, unless I'm mistaken, and I really don't care, we're DQs. I mean, that was kind of the running theme.
Yeah.
Let's just try to throw everything we can at Austin to try to stop him and bring him down so that the Queen Bee herself, Mr. Vince McMahon, can swarm in at the end and take the final parting shot. So all these people were getting DQ'd left and right. I couldn't keep track of what was happening.
There were five, and
certainly now that it's been a few weeks removed since I've seen it, but there were some stunners being doled out. Test was involved. Kane gets involved. Adam, his original Jax Pacific wrestling figure was probably the most unarticulated of all WWE figures. I don't know.
The figure, yeah.
Yeah, it was a piece of shit.
There were five DQs in this match.
You know, give us a little something to nibble on, a little morsel. Give us some ass text or something. I mean, there was nothing here. Test did have, I guess, I'll take that back. He had a decent big boot, a nice big boot. It kind of made me, for a little split second, forget about the Diesel era of WWE. And anytime that happens is a good thing. Some more stunners, some more DQ. And then China does a big low blow. And no Hall of Fame for her.
Nope. I should mention.
Not happening, man. No. Not with Triple H up top.
No way.
Not. It's more. It's going to be more of a lockout than Savage was for the last decade.
Yeah, it's going to be a long time, I think, before we see China in the Hall of Fame.
And so the Guardian Angel, Ray Traylor, a.k.a. the Big Boss Man, gets DQ'd for using the nightstick. And then, Adam, I don't know if you picked up on the sexual subtext, but things got a little weird there. As Michael Cole said, and I quote, "That nightstick is rock hard." End quote.
I didn't pick up hardly anything on this match except it was mess. So
Vince waddles out to the ring in a beige Men's Warehouse suit jacket. And he gets a one, a two, and a three? And at this point, I had to LOL at him because he used that rock hard, that big, black, stiff nightstick.
Yeah. I wrote ending suck, Vince randomly declaring himself a participant and pinning Austin with zero effort.
There was a neat little, all of the that came before it was complete and utter, you know, it was a case of the chili sheds, you know. This was, you know, the only saving grace was at the end. There was a neat little moment where Vince poured some beers onto Austin, and there was this funny part, Adam, too, where, like, so Austin's down in the corner, and outside of the ring, a bunch of the guys are, like, holding him, you know, in place as he gets berated by McMahon, and at one point, Bossman takes his nightstick and kind of holds it on the throat of Austin, keeping his head in place, and you see Vince, just in a moment of madness, swatted away and kind of, you know, verbally berate Boss Man.
Yeah.
Get that off his chest, off his throat. But there is a little face-to-face as the show drew to a close, kind of a nice little closing one-shot of them nose-to-nose, eye-to-eye, just seething rage from Austin as he comes to.
And the cage match between the two was the night after this. This was like the build-up to the cage match. It was trying to get Austin worn down and beaten down for the, you know, so Vince would have an easy time in that cage match.
Yeah.
Next night. But the funny thing is that this was actually taped 6 days before the match.
Yeah.
February 8th of 99 and aired on February 13th of 99. Since we're on the topic of this particular show, I've got it pulled up here. I want to run down the card real quick on this show. And just,
this Sky Dome, this massive Raw, one of the biggest of all time.
Just to give you an idea and everybody listening at home or wherever you're listening, an idea of what was going on at this time in the WWF. So there were two dark matches. We're not even going to get into those, except one of the dark matches featured an appearance by Joey Legend. Yep. So then you have Raw Saturday Night 213, which is the show we were just discussing. D'Lo Brown versus Jeff Jarrett goes 1 minute 11 seconds. Goldberg and versus Goldust goes 1 minute 35 seconds.
Short and sweet, right?
Godfather and Viscera goes 1 minute 22 seconds and ends in a disqualification.
Oh.
X-Pac and Kane goes 2 minutes 58 seconds and ends in a disqualification. Rock versus Steve Blackman, 3 minutes 50 seconds. And then this gauntlet match went 6 minutes 45 seconds.
So in total, you've got about a...
half an hour?
That might even be pushing it.
20 minutes?
Yeah, it sounds like about 20 minutes of in-ring, if that.
There was also a shotgun taping attached to this whole thing. Which actually, the shotgun taping sounded better than Raw itself. So you had Edge and Gangrel against the Hardys, Tiger Ali Singh against Midian, Triple H and Draws, and then Owen Hart against Billy Gunn. So that shotgun lineup sounds much, much better than the Raw lineup.
Yeah. I would watch that, especially Draws against Triple H. Did not know those two paths have crossed. I will be seeking that one out.
Yeah, me too, definitely. So,
Adam, this too was something else. But man, are we going to get strange? Strange days are ahead as we approach the third and final disc. I mean, we're going to be taking a look at some oddities. And I don't just mean that as an adjective. We're going to be actually looking at the oddities.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that faction?
Yeah, it's a match from Shotgun.
And we're going to be looking, at some true oddities. Dungeon of Doom will be coming up, the Straight Edge Society, and three more, which I dare not spoil for you now. But do come back.
Yeah, please come back. We got part three coming up. Real quickly, I should have mentioned this at the top of the show, but I'm going to mention it now. We're going to try to do, I guess it's one show a month probably at this rate, because our schedules are so wonky right now.
Yeah, we don't have like a real firm timetable. We're just going to do these sporadically, when inspiration strikes and we're able to afford ourselves the opportunity to do so. I think one a month is definitely fair. I would like to, occasionally do some more.
Yeah, if we get a bonus show in there every now and then, that's fine. But uh-huh. We're going to shoot for at least one a month. That way everybody has something to look forward to and we can keep on somewhat of a regular schedule.
I mean, we've got a never-ending supply here at Never Hand Over of wrestling. We have enough that we could, lock ourselves into a place for, a couple decades, and we would never dig our way out. So have no fear. There's always something around the corner that we will use our sharp analytical minds to dissect.
That's
in that
right.
Particular Never Hand Over style and fashion.
That's right. Let's see. Yeah, that was pretty much it. I was going to mention that we go one show a month. So,
yeah,
we have a couple of new things up on the blog. There's the Pillman Memorial Review that I just posted a while back. I'm working on a big research article, actually. So be looking for that soon. Follow us on Twitter at NeverHandOver. Shoot us an email if you like the show, nhopodcast@yahoo.com.
Yeah.
We may change that to a Gmail address yet to be determined because there's been a lot of random spam coming up in the Yahoo mail.
And whoever sent me that Best of SD Special Delivery Jones, I don't know if that was a prank or a well-intentioned gif, but I devoured it anyway. Also on the blog in recent weeks, I've tackled some stuff, including TNA's One Night Only, One Night Stand, Knockout Knockdowns, too. That's a mouthful. But if you like the Knockouts division, come join me as I look at Veda Scott in action and so much more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a really fun review you did. Yeah, we got a lot of cool stuff up there. Go online, check it out, neverhandover.blogspot.com. If you read an article, we'd love to hear from you. Leave feedback on the article. It's pretty easy. Just click the comments button, fill out the form, and off you go. So. We appreciate any and all feedback we get, and we will talk to everybody probably, I'm going to estimate, in another 4 weeks or so, maybe sooner, if we can get our
schedules
aligned.
Until then, Adam, I also urge people, I know there is some crossover, if you like cinema, whether you're a cinephile or just a casual moviegoer, check out decadesofcinema.blogspot.com. That's my other podcast with my friend Sean. And we've got a lot of episodes coming up in the weeks ahead. So if you like movies, check that out. And Adam, I'm going to go to a super kick party, so I'm out of here, man. I had a good time.
Yeah, it's been fun. We will talk to everybody later on.